for about an hour about the book. And I'm told she also really enjoys taking questions from the group, so there'll be a nice give and take there. And that's going to last till I think about 2:30, and then we've got to get her to the airport because she has something going on, I believe, outside of Boston that evening. So is there anything you'd want to add to that?
We just want to get the most exposure.
Yeah.
And I would say particularly for the group here to have an opportunity to talk to her.
This chapter that we covered the past 2 weeks, chapter 8, is the window of awakening, and this is where we get into some of the adolescent changes that some of us are seeing in our kids and some of us have already probably experienced. Starting at the top, page 207 through 210, adolescence awakens in the child a world of intense, passionate intrigue. The adolescent's curiosity, emotional sensitivity, and attraction to adventure grow. She writes, in part, teen pain exists because it isn't understood properly by our culture. We see the behaviors, but we don't understand what the teen needs from us to navigate this fraught passage. Adolescents are generally viewed as testing the waters of independence. They deliberately buck authority and frequently act against the wishes of their parents. And I can just say in the Durrell house, we've seen that. At times it can be challenging, but I do think this idea of spirituality and having a strong moral compass certainly help quite a bit.
One of the points there is that in order to deal with somebody, it's helpful if you have some indication of what's going on inside the other person. And we don't think of that age group as stressed or painful. And the facts of the matter are the changes that they're going through are so profound that those words do apply. And we apply something else. In other words, we see the rebellion or whatever ways we want to describe it. But it's an invitation to rethink what's going on in somebody else's life, because then it makes us more capable of touching that life in a way that's appropriate. One of the things that I'd like to do is to put some of these points together in a systematic way, make them available for the parents of the parish, because people are not going to go looking for that. But if we had some material that we could give out to our families in order to support families and children, I think that would make a huge difference. I'd say in the pastoral ministry, one of the things that finally helped me in the pastoral ministry was to try to, in order to talk to somebody, to be able to get in touch with what was going on in them, as opposed to how I wanted to rearrange it. And it makes all the difference in the world.
It seems to me sometimes we don't know what's going on ourselves.
We don't.
So to have somebody help you sort it through and come to understand, whether it's a teenager or...
Right. And they may not be able to describe it to you that way. That's why I thought it was important that if we could attach some of these new words to it that we don't ordinarily attach, then we might look for things that we don't ordinarily look for.
One of the words that she uses throughout this chapter is individuation and spiritual individuation. And she writes, as the process through which the adolescent forms an aware core self, an inner map of the world, and a game plan for living in that world. And she goes on to write that as they're developing this sort of individuation and self, spiritual individuation, this is the most important part of their life to develop it, because this is the way they'll make decisions throughout their entire life. It's this core decision-making process that they start at adolescence that they carry through the remainder of their lives. So it's why this is such a critical time. The adolescent embraces only that which she feels is true to herself. Anything that feels inaccurate or false is dismissed. The self is the teen's instrument for knowing the world, who I am, what I feel and perceive, what I want and value. This all equals me. And then she talks about how this has to be done authentically. They have to do this on their own, and then it takes great work. As the adolescent forges a view of morality, relationships, identity, and passion for work. If you flip over to page 2, the one thing that sort of jumped out at me in pages 215 through 220 is she starts getting into talking about neurons and the network. But the bottom line is, she writes, use them or lose them. So what she's really referencing here is, if your teen doesn't use a capacity, for example, avoids math or reading or face-to-face conversational skills, which I've noticed in a lot of teenagers is a lost art right now. Eye contact and just having a good, solid conversation with someone seems to be fading. She writes, the connections between the region and the others begin to be pruned away. And then she talks, this is what made me realize she's got to have children, and I already sort of knew that, but she says, for instance, Dr. Ronald E. Dahl cautions against long hours of couch potato video games in favor of reflection, math, and sports to cultivate the connective wiring of these neurons. She then, at the bottom of page 3, does this, she compares, she talks about this affluent commuter suburb outside of New York City that she used to really do some research, and she says it was riddled with, the kids there were riddled with anxiety and suffering due primarily to the culture-wide parenting styles. Dr. Luther found that fathers were largely absent and available primarily around weekend events involving accomplishments. Mothers, the majority of them were full-time parents, were found to be perfectionistic, overextended to meet the many activities of the children, and anxious to meet the mark of outward success.
What would you do to sort of summarize that in a way that would be helpful for us? In other words, one of the things there is talking about parenting and what we need to do in order to prepare ourselves to be parents. Paying attention to what's going on in the child. So the parent is a mentor. And so often we don't think of ourselves as mentors. Because a mentor is not somebody that wants to run your life, but somebody that you respect, that you would like to take some of the gifts that you see that they have and make them yours, which is an entirely different kind of paradigm, if you think about that. And then the thing that jumped out to me from that page was the issue of conversation. I would say right now that one of the things that we could do for our families is to encourage and talk to them about family conversation. And to support parents in order to have the kind of level of conversation with a child that will begin to confront this world that we live in today. Because they don't even have conversations with themselves. They have text messaging, which is not a conversation. And I think that we're raising a generation of people who won't know how to talk to each other.
I think that's funny because I find myself getting lazy, uh-huh. And I want to have a conversation with them via text.
Uh-huh.
Because I feel like it's yeah. How bad is that? I'm being honest.
Yeah.
Like,
well, see, Captain says, Dad, text me. And I say, no, I'm going to call you.
Yeah.
I mean, I almost refuse to text unless it's yes, okay, no, yeah. or something like that.
But I do find myself using technology. I just remember my grandmother would always clip articles out of the paper.
Mm-hmm.
Good articles, bad articles. It would just, you know, to make you think, right? So I do find myself coming across pieces of information that I will email them.
Right.
So I did that last night. I read an article about some kids who left prom. I can't even remember what state or where in the country, but at 3:45 there happened to be like a bad wreck and two of the four kids are now deceased.
Dead, yeah.
You know, and I just felt like it was a great opportunity to have a conversation where, and maybe it's not a good opportunity, maybe I'm crazy.
No, I think
but
no.
To be able to just sit down with the girls and say, you know, this is real life here.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk to you about whether you have a curfew or whether we need to know where you are, it's important for us because, you know, things do go wrong at 3:45
mm-hmm.
in the morning after,
that's right.
You know, those type of things.
More
so.
Goes wrong at 3:45 than noon.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But my oldest looked at me like, Mom, I don't know if that's the right approach, but I do feel like trying to look for moments for conversation,
mm-hmm.
trying to, I feel like they're both at the right age
right.
to have those conversations.
And the other thing that caught me about this section, she keeps talking about the brain is still developing. And so we're not talking about a neutral matter. We're really talking about something that is a lifelong issue, that if our brains don't develop as they need to, then we're going to spend the rest of our life with a brain developed as it shouldn't be developing. That's a serious matter, and I think something that, I wasn't, if I remember what she said, certain parts of the brain are developed by age 12, certain by age 15, and other by age 20. And so those are serious issues that we can affect. And I'd be frank to tell you, I didn't know that. And I don't think most parents know that. That's why I think that the church could really do some good for our parents by trying to put together a little manual of some kind about raising our children and put some information in there that would catch our attention so that we might then get people more energized in terms of ways that we can be supported. But I think far and away, the most important way to support our children is to talk with them, have a conversation with them. I don't think there's anything equal to that.
You know, your comment about brain development, it actually continues to 25 or 26.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And that's one of the conversations we've had at length with both our kids, particularly with my son in college, because he's thinking that some drugs are not going to be an issue. And I keep pointing out, your brain's still developing. You may think it's not that big a deal, but you're going to affect how your brain develops.
Or doesn't develop at all.
Or doesn't develop properly.
And your frontal lobe, the judgment part, doesn't develop.
It's the last day.
She talks a lot about that in this chapter.
Your judgment.
The frontal lobe, yeah.
The upper hand
and particularly the boys, I think.
Yeah. And then she talks about how that drives some of the risk-taking that they're willing to really push it to the edge.
The judgment.
Yeah.
Well, I noted the comment there, the three things in the page two about risk, the three.
Risky behaviors, reckless driving.
Risk, drugs, and depression.
Mm-hmm.
And risk-taking. And what I guess, on the risk-taking, I guess because the frontal lobe hasn't developed so much, teenagers or younger people more inclined to do that. And to me, it may be like a rite of passage to prove themselves. But what's behind, what are the thoughts about what's behind the risk-taking to prove yourself?
Well, I think when it talks about developing a life roadmap, that those kind of things are part of that testing. Things out, and we test things sometimes we don't need to test if other issues were being dealt with.
The very end of this chapter, she starts talking a lot about just the idea of positive psychology, and it if you look at the adolescent, and if they have this sort of spiritual roadmap, it helps them focus on grit, which I think we all want our children to have some grit, forgiveness, optimism, And then she says a large host of internal assets. She then references a researcher from Columbia and says these traits generally are considered within the purview of positive psychology and have shown to predict a life of fulfillment, which I think is what we all want for our kids and grandkids. Ideas of compassion, unconditional love, which is a term she uses all the time, help us to cultivate commitment, push us to forgive, and encourage us to create meaningful relationships rather than focusing on hollow ideals of popularity and coolness. And if middle school and high school aren't about that in terms of perception, I don't know what is, particularly with adolescent and teens. So that resonated really well with me. I actually got tired of typing these notes yesterday and had our 15-year-old finish this up, and she said, I don't know. She looked at me, and I said, well, did you pick up on anything in the end of the chapter? And there was a little method to my madness, and she remember when she said this? She looked at the two of us, and she said, I don't know why you need to read a book to know this stuff. That just makes sense. So I thought, oh, thank you, Lord. Maybe we're doing a decent job. She said, you don't need a book to know that.
I'd say you have succeeded.
So I thought, wow, maybe it's working a little bit.
I got my cell phone out because I saw a review of a book written by Angela Duckworth called Grit. And then I'm going to order a copy of it.
Because she has a TED Talk that's very good.
Does she?
Grit. Mm-hmm. You can Google it.
Oh, really?
Angela Duckworth TED Talk. And it's all about her studies. And she's a very brilliant woman and studied grit.
Well, she certainly caught my attention. That's why I wrote it down. And I try to write things down and then go look at them. Now, where were we?
I just sort of wrapped up the chapter. If you want to take over from here.
Well, my main interest in this chapter and in the book that we're doing is how to use this in order to bless our families and our children. In other words, I think that's the reason that we're doing it. And so the question, my question would be, when we get through with all this, are there ways that we could come up with in order to, in other words, how to move the message beyond this group?
And as a parent, the path of least resistance is to basically accept that you're being, or think that you're being pushed away, and just kind of be like,
right.
All right, I'm going to stay out of the way.
That's right.
Which is really not what the kid wants.
And that's kind of what a contemporary attitude is. Let it, let it be, let it be. Well, actually, that's not that. I think this is a really important.
Where are you reading?
It's very bottom of page five.
Page five.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know people who think that when their kids go to college and go even get married after that they don't need them anymore. They need them more in their 20s and in their 30s than they do when they're 15. I mean,
part of it too is interpreting for us as parents what's going on, because aggression is usually a request for help, mm-hmm. as opposed to what we think aggression means. So part of the deal is to be able to interpret what their behavior means. And aggression, I would say 9 times out of 10 is a cry for help. And if you miss the cry, then you'll think it's a demand to quit doing something. And when you interpret it that way, then you've lost the ball game.
But I think too, Molly, and I've heard you say this, that as a parent, we always have a profound impact on our kids. I can think of when I was getting divorced and the impact my father had on me, and my mother as well. But I mean, they're always a part of your life, hopefully.
Yeah.
And can help you, whether it's, resource supporting you, whatever it is. It's not over when they go to college.
Oh, it's not.
No, it's forever.
It is.
It's forever.
Right. It's forever. Yeah.
There's no way to get around it. It is forever.
But there is a lot of pushback against that with the independence of the child now, social media, they give them so much power. And sometimes the more power you give a kid, the more uncomfortable they are because they can't handle it.
Well, I think social media and the media in general enjoy stylizing parents who are mind other people's business and whose relationship is not what it should be. And it's very easy in the comedies to look at those relationships and to see, my goodness, what would I do with that? But that's not the norm. The relationship is forever. And there's no way to get around it.
That's the good news.
What?
I said, that's the good news.
That's the good news.
Yeah.
If it weren't forever, it wouldn't be unconditional. And if it weren't unconditional, it wouldn't be worth having.
I'm struck, and maybe she makes this point in the book, but I'm struck by the notion of how important this unconditional love of a parent for, and of course, that similarity between the love of God for us and the free grace that we give, and it's not conditional upon our behavior. And it just seems to be such a deep resonance. Well, of course, this must be important for your kid because this is the basis of all reality and all relationship with God.
Well, that's why what goes on here in this place is the most important thing in the world, because it focuses on that. That's the focus of everything that goes on down here at that altar. And then what we want that to do is permeate all the behavioral transactions that come out of the community's life. But you know, that's the reason we're here. No, we don't need, God doesn't need our vote. I would say the most important thing that we could do is to just continue to teach that we're not here out of obligation. And that the family is not a place of obligation. And the church is not a place of obligation. Because the minute you make that transition, you've blown the power out of it. One of the things that might be interesting would be to have a class in the fall or sometime about unconditional love as we understand it in Jesus. In other words, since Jesus is our model, I think it would make sense to reflect together about what God's unconditional love looks like in the person of Jesus Christ. It's mind-boggling when you touch it.
Can you say more about that right now, or is it you need to think about it?
Well, just look at the scripture, and you see Jesus washing the disciples' feet. That's a stunning image if Jesus is who he says he is, to wash his disciples' feet. And then in the context of washing the disciples' feet, you see Simon Peter's reaction to that. You know, you won't wash my feet. And Jesus says, if I don't wash you, then you will have no part of me. Then Simon Peter, now this transaction takes place, and then Simon Peter goes on to say to Jesus, I will lay down my life for you. And Jesus says, well, would you lay down your life for me? Before the cock crows twice, you will have denied me three times. And so Simon Peter had no earthly understanding of who he was. But what you saw there was a very gentle opening of a window so that Simon Peter could see himself. Not so that he would go into a funk, but so that in seeing himself in the context of God's love in Jesus, he might have new life. And so when you begin to think about unconditional love in the person of Jesus, every transaction with him always brings us to a reality about ourselves that lets us open the door for new life. It's quite amazing. That's why when you read the scripture, you need to read it relationally. So often we read it informationally. But everything about the scripture is about relationship. And so God comes to us in relationship with the person of Jesus. And so in that relationship, we see what reality, what real humanity is like. And therefore, I think to just have a time of reflection about the person of Jesus and the life of Jesus would be open a window. And then he talks about if you want to find your life, you have to lose it. Well, that's what unconditional love is all about. You can give it away. And you still got more left than you can use. But this chapter 8 was one of the better ones for me. Because I saw things I hadn't seen before.
To the point earlier about young parents meeting together, when Mother Emily Hilden was here 4 years ago, she started small groups, and I think she started two of them, and Sarah and I were in one of them. And it was cool because it did end up being a lot of young parents, but it ended up being us and Buzz and Jenny Matthews, who were about to become young parents, and Abram and Christian Van Engen, who were young parents, and Steve and Denise Sachery, who were not young parents. And I think the Hagemans were part of two, and the Shankowitzes were both in the young parent category. But it was nice that it wasn't exclusively young parents, because it was nice to have it as an intergenerational group. And we've done Bible study sort of things together, and we've done book study sort of things together. And it also reminded me of growing up, when my parents, growing up as conservative Protestants, they were involved in family groups or growth groups or Bible study groups, but I remember lots of times in my life my parents would be getting together with other Christian families. The parents would do their thing. I have no idea what they did. The kids would go play. But that was just kind of a part of my life growing up, seeing this sort of, there's Sunday morning church, which was always a priority for our family, but there was also stuff that happened outside the church building and throughout the week. So that was a good example for me, and one I've been happy to follow. I think for almost our entire marriage, Sarah and I have been involved in some sort of outside of Sunday morning small group gathering. It's felt really healthy.
The word I use with that is appropriation. It's no difference between that and the kids going down to the homeless shelter. It's an opportunity to appropriate and to live into what we say we believe, and to do it with each other in relationship, because that's where the short circuits come, and that's where the life comes.
Well, the other thing I would pick up on what you just said, and then tying it back to something whoever was talking about mentoring, is that it is a good idea to have older, more experienced parents in the group with you, because otherwise you can just all be confused together.
Yeah. And invent all our own mistakes.
That's right. Yeah, reinvent the wheel. Yeah.
Or just repeat the same mistakes without.
Yeah.
You know, what resonated to me about the discussion today in this chapter was the part about the where she did the study on the affluent community and what were the trends she saw there. And I have to say, I feel fortunate to be part of Clayton School District where my daughter goes to school, but it's real easy to get kind of caught up in this, the pace of things now, and it's almost like an embarrassment of riches. Our kids have so many opportunities, and you sort of forget, you can lose perspective real quick about, you know, you just, all of a sudden you look at your calendar and you think, this is insane. You know, this is absolutely insane. It's not really serving us. So having that core about boundaries, you know, our kids need downtime. And talk about brain development, they need time to sleep, they need boundary. They don't need to be every single night going to a different activity.
No, they don't.
Because then where's the homework and where's the,
And yet, I got to tell you, I see how it happens. You kind of don't realize it, and then all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute.
You get caught right in it.
Soccer, she's in the play, she's playing a violin. I mean,
all good stuff.
How are we going to do all this? You know, so you just got to, I don't know. So one of the things we've learned is sometimes when Maya's, we're getting a lot of power struggles or we're getting a lot of attitude on it, we just make her life a lot smaller and have some really, you know, it just turns around real quick. Because I can tell we're out of control and our schedule's out of control and she's feeling, you know. So it's a real easy thing to fall into because you think, like you said, you're being a good parent, right? You want her to, you don't want her to miss any opportunities. Well, you know, it's just real. I see a lot of my friends and a lot of families that are in that cycle and I see how it happens.
So that's what she described that as. She called it success. And boy, what a burden that is.
There are people too that are saying that these children don't have enough time to be still and be creative.
Right.
So the whole, you know, I guess brain development in that area is maybe being compromised as well. I mean, they're busy all the time, and especially in a family that's divorced and the kids are back and forth, and it's totally different environments in each household.
Email survey.
I think summer would be a good time to plan to see what we can do with what we've learned and maybe see if we can multiply.
Okay. So I'm hearing maybe take a little break on the book itself on the summer and maybe we do some planning and Mark, you can help us coordinate, okay?
Well, I think we can, we might find some ways to occasionally meet and reflect together for those of you who can. Might have a little brainstorming session. And we've got a list of everybody who's here.
Yes, I have a list. I think I have everyone's emails. And so then we could send out an email and just say we're going to get together next Sunday. And I would encourage you just keep reading. And maybe if everyone could spread the word when we talk about the most effective way to get people interested. You know, that kind of conversation you're having, I would imagine there are a lot of people your age in those shoes. You know, spreading the word to all of us, to our friends, to friends with children, and just let them know what's going on. And then it's kind of a nice time this summer to catch up and then be ready to go this fall. The second half of this book, as you know, is the adolescents. And we'll lead up to the parenting seminar, which looks like it's going to be on October 23rd. So kind of a great time to get going for the fall.
So
those of you who need to run on, please do. I know some of you need to get to other things, but I'm here available. Deborah,
did you invite? Do we want to invite other churches?
I think we do.
I'm feeling pretty good. I start radiation Monday.
Well, we're going to spread the word. We're going to make it as big as we can.
Thank you.
I think we got it all.